from the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond with Soundings. Conversations and comments featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Soundings now presents the conclusion of a two-part series about education, economic growth, and politics in the modern South. The panelists are the governors of North Carolina, Delaware, Tennessee, and Virginia. Governors James B. Hunt, Jr. of North Carolina, Pierre DuPont IV of Delaware, Lamar Alexander of Tennessee, and Charles S. Robb of Virginia recently came to the Research Triangle Park as members of the Education Commission of the States to participate in a task force on education and economic growth. The governor's appearance on Soundings was arranged through the office of President William S. Friday of the University of North Carolina.
Gentlemen, I'd like to ask you to comment on the connections between the states and the federal government. How do you see that? Is that a liability? Do you worry about that? Keep you awake at night when you worry about education and what Dewey Grantham has called the politics of education in the South? Where does the federal government enter into this mix? Is it a beneficent presence?
We hope that it will continue to be a beneficent presence, I guess. I think there's a recognition on behalf of most of the states that the federal role in education, although they have a traditional responsibility in some areas in particular, that there's not much likelihood at this time that the federal government is going to increase the diversion of limited federal revenues to the states, and the states are willingly accept the responsibility for having the principal role in the formulation of educational policy and educational funding. And I think that that's very much a part and parcel of what this task force report embraces, and that's a recognition of the state's own role and a willingness to assume and accept that role and to, in that instance, to control our own destiny as it relates to education. There has been a continuing debate on the whole question of federalism, in which many of the governors have played a very active role, and the desire on the part of the states generally to ask the federal government to accept the basic responsibility for income maintenance and income support programs and the like, as well as the national defense and other obvious federal programs, but for the states to take the principal funding and policy formulation responsibility in the areas of education, transportation, highways, and other areas, but basically education. We're seeing the evolution of the increased responsibility at the state level without necessarily a corresponding increase in federal responsibility at some of the other areas, which we think structurally makes some sense, but I won't argue that case at this time.
I think there is an appropriate, what I'd rather call a national role. We've got a national problem. This nation has a problem. We've got what's been called a crisis in education. I think that's an accurate term, and I don't think it's exaggerated. Now the question is, what is the nation going to do about it? Having a national problem doesn't mean that the federal government is the only one to solve it. I think it does mean that national leadership ought to help educate the people of America as to the extent of it, the kinds of solutions that are going to be required. For national leadership, one, to ignore it, or second, to sort of establish a climate in which it's hard for government to do things that need to be done. And very clearly, government's got to respond, not the federal government particularly, but at other levels, it has to respond. And for national leadership to establish a climate to make that difficult is counterproductive. And I think it's important. I strongly support the moves toward federalism, the move back toward it. That's what it really is. But I think right now the crisis is so great that if necessary, that's going to have to be put on the shelf a little while so till we get this job done. It has to happen, and we're going to have some help.
Jim Hunt and I could probably have a pretty vigorous argument about the role of the federal government in kindergarten through the 12th grade, but at the end of it, have no trouble at all coming up with a solution we both were very comfortable with. I think most governors feel about the same way, that there is a role for the federal government. I think it ought to be less than more, but that it is a limited role, and it's our job to get things straightened out, and we're willing and eager to do it. The problem I have with the national government is that it has a lot of other things to do that we look to it to do. And when it gets into public education, it's kind of like the neighbor that comes over with a pie before supper and then sticks around to tell you how to cook the rest of the dinner. You know, they make a contribution and then want to do everything else too. But the state and local governments pay about 90% of the bill, and the federal government pays 10. And one of the problems, I think the objective in the discussion ought to be to make sure that the parent and the taxpayer are able to tell whose fault it is if someone can't read at the end of the third grade. Now, they think their congressman is in charge of that, then we've not done our job. It's their governor or their legislator or their school board or themselves.
I would add on to that that help from the federal government in education is a sword with two very sharp edges. They can give you financial support, and that's wonderful. We all like goodies from Washington because it enables us to do things. But it also skews the system you use to select your priorities, because once the federal government has come and started a program, if they then withdraw their support, if they put in a 3 or a 5 year effort, and then they phase out their support, the first reaction of the state educational community is to get money to continue that. And that puts pressure on your priority selection mechanism within your state, which is why we ought to go to a system of block granting. Let the federal government support education, but let us select the priorities in North Carolina and Delaware, Virginia and Tennessee, that we have to solve the problems that are in our states, all of which are different. And that's a much better way for the federal government to help us than coming in and shifting all the priorities around and making it difficult for us to focus our educational system on the particular problems of our communities.
Governors, let me ask you to comment on a news report that I heard recently that in the state of Florida, 3,000, quote, graduating seniors, unquote, are about to be denied diplomas because they have failed literacy tests. They are functionally illiterate. That's tough stuff politically. How would you respond to that kind of a problem? Governor Robb?
Let me just say that I, first of all, would not be judgmental in the case of the Florida system, but I think that any time that an institution of higher education graduates someone, I think that to suggest that they are at least functionally literate is hardly a criterion that we ought to quarrel with, and that if we're graduating people that don't meet that requirement, that really ought to be placed at a much lower level in terms of the educational achievement and competence. I think we're just doing a great disservice to the entire system. One of the difficulties that I think most of us accept as having caused much of the problem today is that we have not demanded as much of our students in recent years as we used to, and that for a period of about 20 years, the SAT scores went down each year, and the general assumption is that the institutions of higher education reduce their standards. Well, if we reduce our standards to the point that we're putting out, we're giving a college diploma to someone who is functionally illiterate, and regrettably, within the high school ranks, we're putting out, I'm not sure of my figures, but it seems to me of the white graduates of secondary institutions, that about 13% are functionally illiterate, a much higher percentage of the minorities, getting up around 40%, and even in the Hispanic group, that there was even an even higher percentage, regrettably. And that is a major condemnation of society and our system of responding to a critical need if we're going to prepare our citizens for not only the workplace but for living and functioning with each other. And so I would not attempt to defend in any way, shape, or form failing to or giving a diploma to anyone who is functionally illiterate. The diploma has to stand for something, and most of the states are moving in the opposite direction. We're considering in Virginia making the diploma increasingly meaningful instead of less meaningful. which has been a result in large part of the so-called social promotion phenomena.
I think one of the best things we've done in North Carolina, at least many principals tell me this, is to put in a rigorous testing program all the way through the system with a competency test required for graduation. You have to pass it. I don't know how many we have failed to pass it, but you have many opportunities to retake that test. And in most schools, I think most students, by the time they get through by intensive remediation, have passed that test. They've learned those basic competencies that they need to get along in the world. I think the best thing I can say about it is to relate the story about 1980. I guess I was running for re-election for governor. I was visiting a plant in Greensboro, North Carolina, and a man came up to me and he said, "Governor, I want to thank you for the competency test in our high schools required for graduation. My daughter flunked it." And I said, "And you're thanking me?" He said, "Yes, because when she flunked it, that school got to work with very intensive remediation help. She realized what she had to do. All of us pitched in to work with her. And she, for the first time in her life, got serious about her studies, and all of these resources surrounded her, helping her. And she's gone on now to become a real student, and she's going to have a future far better than she would have otherwise had." I think that's what's happened with tests, and I think we ought to have more of them, not less.
I agree. In Tennessee, we've established a basic skills first program to try to get at what I think will be where we eventually go with these kinds of tests. We measure progress toward skills between kindergarten and the eighth grade, and our goal by 1990 is to make sure that eighth graders, except for the severely handicapped, know eighth grade skills. Now, that may seem awfully ridiculous as a goal, but it is ridiculous that it has not been a stated goal of society to make sure that eighth graders know eighth grade skills. I think when we do that, we'll get rid of our senior proficiency tests, which now is basically geared to sixth and seventh grade skills, in which you have five chances to pass, in which this year most students pass. But we have to establish those standards not as what we expect schools to teach, because we expect them to teach each child to his or her potential, but to make clear what a minimum course of study is.
Gentlemen, we just have a few minutes left. Let me ask you to conclude by reflecting on this question. What's the one single problem that you would address if you had a wish list and you could wave a magic wand? What would it be? You'd say, "I want to solve this problem." What would that be as you consider the dynamics of education and politics and the Southern economy? Governor Alexander?
I was going to go last, but I'll just go first. I have a very specific wish. I would like to find a fair way to pay teachers more money for doing a good job teaching. I think it comes as a shock to taxpayers and citizens to learn that not one state public school system pays one public school teacher one penny more for doing a good job at what they were hired to do. I think it is a commentary, frankly, on weak leadership over the last 30 or 40 years that we would have let the world change so that women now can get jobs anywhere, more or less, and not recognize that the schools are in the marketplace too for talent, and that we'll not have superior schools unless we can reward superior performance. That's a very tough problem to solve, because it means more money, opposition at this point anyway from the teachers' unions, who I hope change their mind on the subject, and a general lack of interest in public schools in some places for some reason. But we need to find a fair way, fair to the taxpayers and fair to the teachers, to pay teachers more money for doing a good job and to conduct the evaluations that necessarily have to go along with a process like that.
I would select for Delaware a much better integration of the world of education and the world of employment. And my goal would be to make the responsibility, the ultimate responsibility of the education system, not just 12 years of learning, but 12 years of learning plus placement in a job at the conclusion of that learning. And if you could make the responsibility of the education system include job placement at the end, you would begin to focus your efforts somewhat differently. You would involve the private sector. You would be much more oriented towards functional requirements. And I think that would vastly improve the quality of the education system as a whole. It would clearly require a different focus for teachers and educators. It would probably require some additional staff of a different kind to help with that placement effort. But I think in the long run, it would serve the young people of America much, much better to have that kind of an educational focus.
Fortunately, Governor Pete DuPont, who just spoke as one of the national leaders in the school-to-work transition program, and three of us at this particular gathering here are involved in a program that he founded in Delaware that addresses that particular concern. I'd have to say, however, that as far as I'm concerned, for Virginia and for the most intractable problem that we face is more along the lines that Lamar Alexander identified in terms of finding a way to base compensation, which is clearly inadequate for the teaching profession as a whole, on merit, on a pay-for-performance plan. The difficulties that surround implementation of such a plan are so great that no state has successfully implemented it at the state level. In Virginia, we do have a couple of local jurisdictions that have a variation on that theme, but the leadership that Governor Alexander has already exerted in this field, whether or not the specific master teacher plan that and the compensation plan that he is proposing to his legislature is ultimately the most advantageous for his state or other states, the very fact that we're moving in that direction seems to me to be terribly important. And to solve that problem, which cannot be solved with money alone, if I could select one wish to fulfill, it would certainly be in that area.
I would wish that in North Carolina we could help families provide the wonderful, enriching early childhood experiences, preschool experiences that are needed for intelligence to develop and for a good, healthy, emotional situation to develop. I'm convinced that if in those first 5 years the right kinds of things happen with children, that we can do things with schools and colleges and universities and in this society that we've never dreamed of. I think that's the most important place to focus, and I think it's primarily the family, except that families aren't what they used to be now. And I think that's, if I had one wish, it would be that every child in those first few years would have the kind of loving, caring, helping relationship and situation to help that child burgeon out all that's within him.
You're listening to Soundings from the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond with the second of two programs about education, economic growth, and politics in the modern South. The panelists were Governors James B. Hunt, Jr. of North Carolina, Pierre DuPont IV of Delaware, Charles S. Robb of Virginia, and Lamar Alexander of Tennessee. The governor's appearance on Soundings was made possible through the assistance of President William S. Friday of the University of North Carolina. The discussion of education, politics, and the Southern economy continues now with a conversation with Dewey Grantham of Vanderbilt University. Professor Grantham recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center, where he worked on a book about 20th century Southern politics. Well, Dewey, let me ask you to reflect on what you have heard the governors discussing, the connections among and between education and economic growth and politics in the South. From the standpoint of Southern history, why did the region lag behind for so long? How do you account for that?
Some of the points significant here were discussed in our earlier conversation. But I think we might elaborate a few of those matters. The matter of poverty, mm-hmm. And the South's lag in comparison with national averages in wealth and income certainly would be significant. in explaining the South's long-time lag in educational performance, indeed in establishing a genuine educational system. But I think a number of other points might also be made. One would be the disruption of the Civil War and Reconstruction. And despite the fact that during Reconstruction, radical Republicans really introduced the first educational system that amounted to very much in most southern states. And they did have as a part of their agenda significant changes in society and politics and the economy. And one of their reforms was education. Now, this proved to be short-lived, and the reaction against the radicals in the post-Reconstruction period was such that education suffered undeservedly, I think.
Now, what about racial discrimination?
Race certainly would be important. Southern whites, by and large, did not feel, certainly in the 19th century and well into the 20th, that blacks should be educated in the same way that whites were. Many Southerners, I think, that is whites, did approve, at least on paper, a kind of vocational education for blacks. They praised Booker T. Washington's program. But it is a fact, it seems to me, that blacks were long discriminated against in the field of education, as in many other areas, and the implications and repercussions flowing out of the racism that permeated the society hindered the region in developing its educational system. Also, Southerners had more children to educate. That demographic fact over time proved to be a barrier to the adequate education of children. So the blacks were brought into the system, the need to operate a dual system of education made it more difficult to provide a good system of education. Furthermore, it seems to me that it took a long time, really, to establish a system in a rural society where the population was widely dispersed, to provide consolidated schools and schools that really operated for 8 or 9 months during the year, and that had enough support to be counted as anything like adequate schools.
What are the prospects? First of all, consider the question about the South still lagging behind. Is that the case?
Well, as I think Governor Alexander in our discussion noted, we have made significant progress, particularly since 1945, and we've narrowed the gap between the regional averages in educational expenditures and other measures of performance, but between the regional averages and the national averages. But the region still lags somewhat behind the national performance. To respond a little more directly to your question about prospects for the future, I'm rather optimistic about the region's chances for further economic and educational progress. For one thing, it seems to me that education should benefit from the economic takeoff of World War II and the considerable prosperity and the regional economic diversification that exists now. We've all heard so much about opportunities in the South, in the Sun Belt, in the southern sector of the nation, that we're aware of opportunities and compensations that industrialists and other businessmen find in this region. So it seems to me that the growing economic well-being and the better prospects augur well for the educational progress of the region. Perhaps equally important is the progress, as I see it, made in school desegregation. The dismantling of Jim Crow, the considerable progress made in school desegregation, the banishment or the approaching banishment of the whole specter of racism as an overt consideration in the school system should free Southern educators and political leaders and other leaders to get on with the task of finding adequate resources for schools, working at educational performance, recruiting good people for the classroom, and things of that kind. The recognition of the role of education in state government seems to me also to be a significant and promising aspect of the future. Don't you think the fact that these four governors are all, and I think they're representative of regional and national involvement on the part of states and governors in education, the fact that they are all deeply concerned
about education,
yeah. All have programs of one kind or another, presumably to elevate, improve the systems in their states. The fact that in the budgets of these states, and I think this is true generally, no less than 40% of the revenues are devoted to education.
Dewey, what did the governors leave unsaid?
That's a good question. I think there were, and this is very natural, there were aspects of the educational picture which they might have picked up on. They talked a good deal, and I thought very responsively, about the politics of education. But one could not, I think, from the brief analysis that they provided, learn too much about what it's like to work with the legislature or to work with special interest groups.
But that wouldn't be particularly Southern, would it?
No, I don't think so. Yeah. I think that's a national phenomenon.
Uh-huh.
How do you implement... as Governor Robb put it, a program that you and your assistants formulate and consider to be a good program.
Dewey Grantham is a professor of history at Vanderbilt University. The program is Soundings from the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond with the conclusion of a two-part series on education, economic growth, and Southern politics. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities.